TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Fukushima Symposium 2013. Bob Alvarez. Spent fuel pools and radioactive waste. Bob Alvarez, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, became the focus of intense character assassination by the nuclear industry when he wrote in April 2012, quote, "Why Fukushima is a greater disaster than Chernobyl and a warning sign for the United States," end quote. The reason for his grave assessment was a long-overlooked problem in nuclear power, the so-called spent fuel pools. When a spent nuclear fuel assembly is removed from a reactor core, the radioactive emissions are so high that standing next to them causes instant death. For 5 years, those fuel rods remain too hot, both thermically and radiologically, to be removed from the fuel pool, where they need to be constantly cooled. After 5 years, they can and should be moved from the pool to dry storage in caskets or casks. Far from being spent and harmless, fuel rods remain highly dangerous for a very long time. When the U.S. government was looking for permanent storage for high-level waste, which includes fuel rods, they were looking for a site that would remain safe for at least 100,000 years. Not surprisingly, they found none and had to recognize that Yucca Mountain, Nevada, was not safe either. And now the high-level waste builds up at each nuclear power station. Since dry cask storage is expensive, the nuclear industry convinced the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to allow them to keep adding fuel to the existing nuclear fuel pools, which, by Alvarez estimates, will be full in 2015. In the talk you are about to hear, Bob Alvarez makes the point that spent fuel pools are the Achilles heel of nuclear power plants. They are vulnerable to cutoffs of water and electricity, have no containment, can be easily sabotaged, and, to make things worse, are in very unsafe locations as far as the General Electric Mark I and II designs are concerned. As photos of Fukushima show clearly, the fuel pools 100 feet up in the air at the top of the destroyed buildings are now highly vulnerable to another earthquake or tsunami. That overlooked fuel pool problem led Bob Alvarez to write in April 2012, quote, "The radioactive inventory of all the irradiated nuclear fuel stored in spent fuel pools at Fukushima is far greater and even more problematic than the molten reactor cores." Alvarez's assessment concerns us here directly, since almost one-third of the U.S. fleet of nuclear reactors are of the same design as Fukushima, and we have even more fuel stored in those fuel pools at the top of the Mark I and II reactors. Alvarez came to the Institute for Policy Studies from important organizations in the nuclear field before serving as policy advisor to the Secretary and Deputy Assistant Secretary for National Security and the Environment. Alvarez worked for 5 years as a senior investigator for the U.S. Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs, chaired by Senator John Glenn. And he was one of the Senate's primary staff experts on the U.S. nuclear weapons program. The talk you are about to hear was given at the Fukushima Symposium, held at the New York Academy of Medicine, New York City, in March 2013. The two-day event with speakers from across the world was a project of the Helen Caldicott Foundation, co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. Here's Bob Alvarez.
The Fukushima accident clearly demonstrated the dangers of spent nuclear fuel storage. The explosions exposed the pools themselves, showed how shoddy construction was, and that they basically are warehouses never intended to hold the quantities that they are now holding. This is something I borrowed from Gordon Edwards. And Gordon provided, I thought, was an excellent explanation as to why these spent fuel pools pose greater dangers. Each pool contains irradiated fuel from several years of operation. It contains several cores, not just one core from a reactor. They do not have strong containment. They do not have the secondary barrier of concrete and steel. In the United States, we have spent fuel storage in buildings that you would find at big box stores and car dealerships. Several pools are now completely open to the atmosphere. These pools of this particular design are 100 feet above the ground. And now that the structural integrity is of serious question, further aftershocks and quakes might cause drainage or toppling of the pool itself. Once the water starts to drain, you have to understand that after a point at which the water drains, the radiation levels become so prohibitively large that they will actually prevent emergency crews from actually intervening, because then you're getting at lethal dose rates on the order of 500 R per hour at maybe 50, 60, 70 yards. And that the loss of water could result in the overheating from decay of the fuel, which then caused melting and then what's called a exothermic reaction or spontaneous fire of the zirconium cladding or the metal tubing around the fuel, which could then result in a large deposit of radioactive material. When I was in the Energy Department, we looked at a spent fuel pool problem at the Hanford site, and that had been ignored for decades. And at the closeout briefing, we asked, well, what would happen if there was an earthquake and the water drained and there was a hem and a haw and hem and a haw? And finally, some old-timer basically said, well, there would be a fire that would make Chernobyl look like a pimple on a pumpkin. Irradiated fuel, it's extremely radioactive, as some of you all know. Being anywhere near this, you'll receive a lethal dose. But I think there is official recognition by the United States government itself through the Government Accountability Office, who considers spent nuclear fuel to be considered one of the most hazardous substances on the earth. And what I want to talk about is essentially the environment, safety, and health burden which has been imposed upon us that we have to start taking seriously from this detritus. The spent fuel pool at Fukushima number 4 contained roughly about 37 million curies of long-lived radioactivity and about 10 times the amount of cesium-137 that was released by the Chernobyl accident. This should be a very, very high priority. It's not going to be easy. This is not simply getting a crane in there and lifting it out as if it's some sort of cargo on a ship and putting it somewhere else. You're talking about having to lift objects that are on the order of 100 tons. The basic infrastructure that allows a safe movement and removal of the spent fuel was destroyed. It has to somehow be restored. All the spent fuel has to be done underwater with nuclear safety rated cranes, and it has to be transferred into a network of other pools. There isn't just one pool. You'll see it involves an infrastructure. We don't know the condition of the racks. We don't know whether the damage of the racks is such that the fuel assemblies are stuck and whether that's going to be a problem. But assuming everything moves swimmingly well, you're looking at a rate of transfer of somewhere on the order of there's about 1,331 assemblies. If we're lucky, we're moving probably 9 or 10 assemblies at a time, and that takes quite a bit of time and effort. So then those assemblies will have to be put into some sort of dry cask, thick-walled concrete and steel container. That's going to have to dry out. It's then have to be lifted up by a very large crane, placed in some sort of transport facility, and probably moved to the central pool where they have to thin that pool out because they don't have enough room for the spent fuel and the radioactive ruins right now. Since the early 1980s, the U.S. Regulatory Commission, with the expectation that the United States would open a permanent repository for the permanent disposal of spent fuel and defense high-level radioactive waste, basically approved high-density storage. These pools are now storing 4 to 5 times more spent fuel than what they were originally designed to hold. The pools were originally intended to be temporary storage facilities for a period of 5 years. And therefore, they did not impose or require them to have what are called nuclear safety-rated defense in depth requirements. These pools do not have secondary containments. Some of these pools have buildings with tin roofs. As I said, some of these pool structures are you would find the kind of structure you would expect to find at a Costco, a Walmart, or a Ford dealership. They do not require them to have redundant power. They do not require them to have separate independent water makeup capability. And only after the Fukushima accident did the Nuclear Regulatory Commission get around to requiring the reactor operators for the first time to have instrumentation in their control rooms to tell them water levels, water chemistry, and water temperature of the pools. Before that, people had to go and look in the room. And there was at least one occasion when they didn't do that for a while and discovered the water level dropped dramatically, and there have been some problems. The pools in the United States have much more spent fuel in them than those in Japan. And that's because they become indefinite storage modes for the nuclear industry because it saves money. Since the 1990s, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission have basically allowed our reactor operators to double the time of irradiating fuel in reactors by increasing the amount of uranium-235 from 3.5 to roughly 5%. And so right now, the U.S. nuclear power fleet is allowed to operate at the highest burn-up rates in the world. And this is really motivated by economics and not necessarily by waste management. There are now some questions being raised. In the summer of last year, some of the engineers from the National Research Council said the technical basis for the spent fuel currently being discharged, high utilization burn of fuels, is not well established. In addition, spent fuel that may have degraded after extended storage may present new obstacles to safe transport. And this is very important because we're now getting into matters of decay heat and thermal heat. We've talked a lot about radiation, but for reactors and for reactor storage safety and disposal, the safety of permanent disposal, a very, very key factor is thermal heat that is given off by decay. Strontium-90 gives off nearly 1 watt per gram. Cesium-147, about 0.42 watts per gram. This is a lot of heat being given off, and this it has a lot of implications. They have been observing elongation of the cladding, the thinning of the cladding. We're talking about cladding, by the way, that is between 0.04 millimeters and 0.08 millimeters. What does that mean? Think about extra heavy-duty aluminum foil. That's how thick the cladding is surrounding the pellets. Spent fuel pools are going to run out of storage by the year 2015. So the industry is, this is one of the big elements, is forcing the industry into dry storage, but not to thinning out their pools. The idea is to keep these pools filled to the brim by packing them more closely together. And then when they run out of that, they'll then get around to building dry casks. By the year 2015, the pools are going to be maxing out, even with this high-density configuration. I mentioned decay heat. This is a very, very important issue, as I said. From the point of view of safety in terms of spent fuel storage, the loss of water is a very serious matter for spent fuel. The National Academy of Sciences basically, I think, came up with a good explanation of what happens when you lose water and it heats up. The zirconium basically will spontaneously combust at somewhere around 800 degrees centigrade. They said it is strongly exothermic. The result could be a runaway oxidation, referred to as a zirconium cladding fire, that proceeds as a burn front, e.g. as seen in a forest fire or firework sparkler. This is sort of what a spent fuel fire would look like. And it's largely due to the enormous decay heat and the reactivity of zirconium. In 2003, several colleagues and I were stricken from the Christmas card lists of a lot of people in the nuclear industry. When we published a paper basically raising the concern about the vulnerabilities of spent fuel pools, particularly to acts of terror and other events like earthquakes. And what we did is we took the literature of the last 25, 30 years of nuclear spent fuel pool safety and took it to its logical extreme. The nuclear industry, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, was not happy with us and issued quite a few statements and papers, et cetera, in rebuttal. And this prompted the U.S. Congress to ask the National Academy of Sciences to sort this out. We then went before a special panel, and this is what one of my colleagues, Frank von Hippel, presented to them as to what we're looking at in a sort of a generic sense of what might happen if you have a pool fire. A pool fire at a commercial nuclear power plant in the United States could be as large as 60 times greater than the essentially the cordon sanitaire around Chernobyl. We also provided some damage estimates, just the standard damage estimates that the industry uses to give you an idea of what the monetary possible carcinogenic estimates would be, just using the standard formulas that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission uses. This kind of accident, such as Chernobyl, similar to Fukushima, deal body blows to entire nations. They are highly destabilizing to the stability of an entire country when you have events like this happen. The National Academy came back a year later, and this is what they had to say. They basically agreed with us. They basically pointed out that these pools are particularly vulnerable to terrorist attacks and that these fires could be quite significant. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission essentially flipped the bird and really did nothing to acknowledge the importance of this study, as far as I can tell. Now, you've heard yesterday from David Lockbaum that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has made the statement that the dangers of dry versus wet storage are the same. This happens to be a chart that I took out of a document by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission Emergency Operations Center. As a recovering bureaucrat of the Department of Energy, I'm familiar with operating in parallel universes. And this is the other universe. This is the Emergency Planning Center. This is the data that they're using to do desktop planning and their exercises. This is based on the Rascal Code model, and this gives you an idea, and this is a source. It's on the internet if you wanted to bother to find out. And this involves a reactor, interestingly enough, called the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station. It's a workbook. It explains, you know, how to use this code, and it gives you problems. And it says, well, you've just received a phone call from the staff at San Onofre, and they've had an earthquake. The roof is gone. The pool is draining. They've put a full fresh core load in there, and the tops are already being exposed. What do you do? How do you ascertain what to expect? And this is what the answer was. The amount of radioactivity that would be released in the environment would be 86 million curies. About 26 million would be cesium-137. Your doses within 1 to 10 miles would essentially be prompt lethal to killing half of the people or giving the LD50 dose, 450 to 5,200 rems. These are all what you would call oblation doses, destruction of the thyroid, period, for people within a 10-mile radius. This is the NRC's parallel universe here. This is the inside versus what they say to the outside. They also gave an exercise about, well, a terrorist has basically put a shape charge on a cask at the Prairie Island nuclear station. And how do you figure out what the release will be and what the doses would be? Well, this is the comparison. A cask would release as much as 34,000 curies of radioactivity versus 36 megacuries. Your doses, Everybody within a 10-mile radius essentially would have a near lethal, if not a lethal, prompt lethal dose. Your off-site dose is now at Prairie Island, as some of you might know. That reactor is cheek and jowl with a small Indian tribe. These are their dose estimates. Your thyroid doses, your total effective dose equivalent, are just off the chart. I may add, by the way, do you know what's in the 10-mile radius of the San Onofre Nuclear Power Station? The world's largest United States Marine Corps base, Camp Pendleton. And that within that 10-mile radius are 64,000 people who are Marines and support people. And I'm curious whether anybody has thought about what this means to our national security. Has anyone bothered to call up the base commander and say, are you aware of this? Are you ready for this if something like this were to happen? Probably not. A lot has been written, said about Fukushima. What I find interesting about certain things are things that are usually not said. And what I found to be one of the most interesting lessons that I gained from the Fukushima disaster is that they had 9 casks at the site, and they were unscathed by the earthquake and the tsunami and all the other aftermath. That's a very important finding. Very important finding. We recommended in 2003 that we return these spent fuel pools to their original purpose, which is for temporary storage for a 5-year period to allow decay heat to move them. And we suggested that they thin out these pools and restore them to original use and place the remainder into dry hardened storage. We estimated it would cost about $3.5 billion to $7 billion. It would take about 10 years. The Electric Power Research Institute recently came out with a study and said it would be about $3.9 billion. And they said it would mean a lot of reactor downtime, and they would not make a lot of money, as they are. I believe they treat these reactors like ATM machines. And we're looking at an enormous reduction in the potential consequences and risks and hazards of doing this. Now, one thing we have to keep in mind right now is that we are stuck. The whole framework for the disposal of high-level radioactive waste has collapsed in this country. The Yucca Mountain site has been pulled off the table. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission's waste confidence rule, in other words, their rule that says we can jam as much spent fuel as possible into these pools, has been rejected by a federal court, largely on the grounds that their assumptions about the consequences of spent fuel fires did not pass the laugh test. And so they are now embarked on a very time-consuming environmental impact statement. As I said, the maximum high-density spent fuel pools are going to reach their maximum storage by 2015. The other thing to keep in mind is that we have an abundance of a large and long-term abundance of natural gas, which is making these older single-unit reactors more and more vulnerable economically. This is putting more pressure on this industry, who are much more economically motivated than they are with respect to waste management. And we also have to keep in mind that we have large amounts of defense high-level radioactive waste that are stranded. Just a brief word about military high-level radioactive waste. We have about 100 million gallons in tanks that are larger than most state capitol domes. Roughly a third of them leaked. After 30 years, we've spent about $120 billion trying to stabilize them, and we've been able to stabilize about 11% of the radioactivity. This is a matter of very high national concern and priority, because we're talking about protecting streams like the Columbia River, the Savannah River, the drinking water supply, the South Eastern Coastal Plain of the United States. These are very important issues. My conclusion: we've been looking for a place to dispose of these wastes for actually close to 60 years now. But one thing I think you need to understand and have to come to terms with is that some of the largest concentrations of radioactivity on the planet are going to remain in storage at U.S. reactors. I think this is something you have to think about very seriously for the indefinite future. I think that we have put the disposal cart before the storage horse. We've always thought that we would find a place and there was no need to take the extraordinary steps that nations like Germany have done to protect our spent fuel. And I think we need a national policy that basically takes the hazards of these pools, reduces the hazards, and establishes a safe storage policy before we start to find a geologic repository. Storage and stabilization of military high-level waste should also be national priorities. This is all going to be quite expensive. And as I said, the costs of fixing America's high-level radioactive waste storage vulnerabilities are high. The costs of doing too little are incalculable. Thank you.
That was Bob Alvarez, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, who formerly worked as policy advisor to the Secretary for National Security and the Environment, and as a senior investigator for the U.S. Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs. You can see his whole talk and the PowerPoint slides on the website of the Helen Caldicott Foundation at nuclearfreeplanet.org. The link to streaming video is also at TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. This is part two of a mini-series based on the testimony by scientists and researchers on nuclear construction and safety, the continuing emissions at Fukushima, and the spread of radiation across the globe. The two-day event on March 11 and 12, 2013, was organized by the Helen Caldicott Foundation and co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. It was held at the New York Academy of Medicine in New York City. In TUC Radio's newest program section, you can also hear or download this program and sign up for future podcasts. Or you can order a CD of the first two speeches in this mini-series with Arne Gundersen and Bob Alvarez. You can get information on how to order the CD, What Did They Know, When Did They Know It, by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.